for those of a nervous disposition, perhaps a more even nervous stomach muscles, then this is the perfect interview for you. Cannibalism, a perfectly natural history. For centuries, scientists have written off cannibalism as a bizarre phenomenon with little biological significance. Its presence in nature was dismissed as a desperate response to starvation. However, in Cannibalism, a Perfect Natural History, zoologist Bill Shutt sets the record straight, debunking common myths and investigating our new understanding of cannibalism's role in biology, anthropology, and history. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the States, and having just had his breakfast and I just had my lunch, is the author of Cannibalism. Good morning to you. Good afternoon from us. Good morning to
you,
Bill.
How are you, Giles? How are things?
I'm very well, Bill. And yourself?
Very, very good. Can't complain.
Right then. So, I mean, I mentioned to the my technical and my production assistants that I wanted to do an interview on cannibalism, and they grimaced in a way that I haven't seen anybody grimace for a very, very long time indeed. It is the great taboo. But we're not just talking about, you know, the theory of eating your own relatives, but we're looking at the theory of cannibalism throughout the natural world as well, presumably.
Yeah, but I was also really fascinated by the knee-jerk reaction that you just described,
yeah.
And so I had to go in and try to figure out why we have that that response, and it's sort of universal. I'm a zoologist, and I've sort of found a niche as a writer, looking at things that might be macabre or scientifically complex. So the last book I did, I worked on, was about the heart and the circulatory system. And before cannibalism, it was Dark Banquet, which was about blood-feeding creatures and vampirism. And, you know, and I was a kid that had all the different animals when I was growing up. And when I got to Cornell working on my PhD, I studied vampire bats. So nobody's really that surprised when they find out that, you know, that I've written a book about cannibalism, or, you know, that I've worked on vampiric species and things like that. And really, I became interested in demystifying those topics, and trying to find a spot, a niche between the really sensationalized garbage that's out there and then the real academic stuff on the other side. And I've been really lucky. Cannibalism is, you know, to me, the gift that keeps on giving. It's been my most successful book so far.
I mean, the thing is, when you mention cannibalism, there's two immediate thoughts, things to spring to mind. I mean, we will think, okay, Papua New Guinea, you know, natives sitting around the pots waiting for the next, you know, white man to come along. Or B, they think, you know, Andes, 1972, Uruguayan plane crash, etc. So, I mean, there have been examples of cannibalism throughout history, and a lot of it, as you said before, you know, you like the dark side, like young Skywalker. So, you know, why particularly do you think it is such a taboo amongst us, at least especially amongst Europeans?
I think it's been drilled into us over the centuries, and really, you know when I started to think about this and do the research, I was going to name the chapter Blame It on the Greeks. And that's because if you go back to some of the earliest Greek writing, if you go back and look at Homer and Herodotus, they were the ones who determined that cannibalism was really the worst thing that you could do. It was not what Greeks did. It's what other groups of people that they encountered did. And from there, that got passed on to the Romans, like Seneca. And you know, it just went on and on. Shakespeare, the Brothers Grimm, you know, all of the fairy tales, Daniel Defoe, and you know, and modern, well, not so much modern, but some of the first anthropologists, you know, they just expected to find cannibals, and it just snowballed to the point where you've got this, you know, you have this reaction when I say that word, and you know, and it also ties into food, and you know, when you have food and the ultimate taboo, then you really have fascination, and you know, what people eat is often used to delineate outsiders, and that's been the case from, you know, since the time of the ancient Greeks.
And I suppose, looking at it in a sort of in a Judeo-Christo kind of way, if you look at the two things that, you know, define you, the two worst, if you like, things that happen to you are beheading, which is, you know, the worst method of execution in several cultures, and cannibalism, because obviously you're eating the body, the sacrament, the whole thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Christians believe that their bodies and that your body and soul are going to be reunited on Resurrection Day, and so you need your bodies intact. Cannibalism sort of puts a crimp on that.
let's go to the natural world though, because you are a zoologist, and there are, I mean, people will be thinking, oh, well, I remember this now, because there are certain species that, you know, bite the heads off their mate after mating. I think it's the praying mantis, for example.
Yep.
Spiders that eat their mates. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, getting it on in the insect world is a pretty deadly game.
Yeah, those are the two that, you know, it's black widow spiders and praying mantises, and those are the two that everybody thinks about in the animal kingdom. And when I started to write this book, that's what I thought. And what I discovered was that over the past, say, 40 years, all of these researchers had been doing work on their individual, animals of choice. Nobody really put the big story together, but across the entire animal kingdom, there's cannibalism for reasons that really have nothing to do with what they thought. They thought it was about a lack of food or stressful conditions. You put these animals into like a cage or a small fish tank, and they're going to consume each other. And yes, that happens with, say, hamsters, which are a very popular pet in the United States. And you know, a lot of kids wake up and then they look in the tank, and all of a sudden it's this like gruesome disaster in there. And that's because hamsters are just not, they didn't evolve to be sitting in a fish tank or a cage. So stress is involved. But there are all sorts of reasons across the animal kingdom that have to do with things like parental care or a lifeboat strategy. If you've got three eggs are laid by, let's say, an egret, and two of them are laid early, and the hatchlings are going to have more hormones in them than the third little guy who hatches. And you know, if there's food around, then eventually they'll just kind of boot that hatchling out of the nest. But if there's not a lot of food around, then they'll consume that hatchling. So that, and you know, it is certainly a reproductive strategy for animals that go way beyond spiders. For example, if a lioness has a cub and she moves into with another group of animals, the lead male may kill that.
Yeah.
The cub, in order to terminate the maternal investment in the cub, so that the female becomes more receptive to reproducing with him. And that happens in bears, happens in so most of the big cats. So these were the things, you know, the list went on and on, and a lot of them had nothing to do with a lack of food or stress.
And also, I mean, it's interesting, you must be reading my mind down the line, because I was about to mention that thing about lions, about when they, you know, when a new male lion comes and there's a lion that's around, he will get rid of the male lineage, and obviously that's a source of protein hanging around, and the natural kingdom isn't exactly squeamish when it comes just to thinking, oh, well, it's protein, what the hey?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this happens. If you look at fish, most fish are cannibals, and if they're laying thousands and thousands of eggs, then they're not looking at those eggs going, well, there's Ted and there's Sally over there. They're thinking, you know, it's more like there's some raisins. And so some of those eggs, which are very easy to consume, and you're not going to have to fight for them, or there's no danger involved. It's a really handy little meal, and you've got hundreds, maybe thousands of other eggs laying around, so it's not a big deal to consume some of those.
Let's go.
You know, we all grew up. I don't know. You ever see these shows where you'd see mouth brooding cichlids, the fish are called, and at a moment's notice, when things get scary, the little babies all, you know, swim really quickly into their father's mouth.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, isn't that really cute? And in reality, a lot of those young get eaten. And if the numbers dwindle to a certain point, then they all get eaten. And it's sort of like, all right, well, just kind of cut loose from this batch and move on.
Something tells me that the Walt Disney movie channel wouldn't have exactly been good at that if Ricky the Fish didn't make it back out again from Daddy's mouth.
Oh, yeah. Those scenes definitely wind up on the cutting room floor.
Let's move on then. member from that, and let's go over to our own species, or at least a close relative, Neanderthals. Now, they get a bad rap, although recently there has been, and I'm talking to you, and 30 minutes down the road from me is Gibraltar, where there was quite a big Neanderthal colony, and others would say there still is one, but that's going to move on from there. But
right.
They have got a bad rap in terms of the eating of each other and the eating of human flesh, because it was kind of, was that sort of put on them to say, well, you know, by... I don't know, 18th century, 17th century explorers have said, well, you know, as fully upright Homo sapiens, of course, we didn't used to eat each other.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a prejudice against them right from the start. And a lot of it had, you know, when I was a kid, when you saw cartoons or figures of Neanderthals, they were sort of like hunched over, they were dragging their women around by the hair, they had a club. In reality, what they did when they reconstructed the first Neanderthal fossils, they reconstructed the skeleton of an individual who had severe arthritis. So he was all hunched over when they reconstructed him. And then they decided that it wasn't going to be, you know, that's not where humans came from. So the pictures that they drew had a nest in the back. So you would think in terms of, something like a chimpanzee rather than a human. You know, in reality, they had a brain that was larger than modern human brains. Did they cannibalize? I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's our culture that came along later on, and not only probably hammered the Neanderthals into the ground like a tent peg at a certain point, or bred them out of existence. But we also, you know, we're the ones who said that consuming the dead is wrong. You know, and that was a theme in this book. And that's the difference between the animal kingdom and humans, is that our individual cultural groups decide what is right and what is wrong. Culture is king. And so when you get anthropologists going into South America or New Guinea and coming across cultures that are consuming their loved ones as sort of funerary rites, the anthropologists are mortified. And when you're trying to explain to the indigenous people that no, you're supposed to be burying your dead, then they're just as mortified at the idea of putting their loved ones in the ground and letting them get eaten by worms. Long story short, we're the ones who determined that the Neanderthals were sort of subhuman. In reality, they were not.
And if you look at sort of one of the current memes, you know, things going around the internet is saying, you know, the problem with the world in the 21st century is the fact that nobody drinks from the skulls of their enemies anymore. And that's a fact. But if you think about it, you know, going back to tribal, and I'm not just talking Papua New Guinea, but I'm talking, you know, European Germania, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that if you beat your opponent in a bloody battle at some point in the what is referred to wrongly as the Dark Ages, then it was a mark of honor to rip out your enemy's heart, and if you want to take a bite out of it, go for it. And the same in, you know, Papua New Guinea, if they have a culture of doing quite interesting things to the vanquished bodies, including the, you know, the famous shrunken heads, etc.
Right.
And you know, you look at the book like Mark Shan's Skullduggery and stuff like that, and again, there is a thing, is, you know, you've vanquished your enemy, so
yep.
Either get some, if you fought bravely, then get some of that bravery by, you know, chewing down on whatever body part you can find.
Oh, yeah. I mean, vengeance cannibalism was certainly something that I talked about, and the Japanese did it during World War II.
Really?
You know, so, yes, this is definitely something that if you want to put the fear of whatever god or gods that you believe in into the another group, then cannibalize their warriors.
Just dial me back on that one. The Japanese practiced cannibalism in the Second World War. That, I haven't come across that one before.
Yeah, prisoners. There are reports that that prisoners of war were cannibalized by officers.
Wow. Okay.
And a number of them were actually executed after the war because of those types of war crimes.
Right. I hadn't come across that one before. That is indeed quite shocking. Let's move on then to some of the ones that the people, perhaps, because it's cropped up in extraordinary circumstances throughout history. And I only came across this one recently, again through the wonders of the internet. But The Doner Party. Now, if you are familiar with Turkish cuisine, you will know that there's a thing called the Doner Kebab, which is
completely different.
It's completely different. But this is again, I hadn't read it because I subscribe to various American news websites, and it was one of those little rabbit holes, you know, of a quiet afternoon, and you know how you sometimes get distracted in the thing of brackets research. But this was quite something. The Sierra Mountains and the Doner Party is really a fascinating, if extremely dark, chapter in the founding of the New World, if you like.
It's the biggie in the United States. When you mentioned the Andes, the rugby team that was there, and some of the other events. But when you mention human cannibalism in a historical perspective in the United States, people are going to think about the Doner Party. At least many do, because that's the one that we've heard about. So I went into that thinking, geez, everything's been written about this. I wrote a book about blood feeding creatures, and I didn't write about a lot about mosquitoes because I thought it had been done well and done quite often. So when I went into the Doner Party, when I looked at this, and just to sort of briefly describe what happened, it was 87 pioneers took off from St. Louis and headed west. And the thing is that they had to get over the Rockies and Sierra Nevadas and get into California in what is now Sacramento before the snows closed the passes off in the mountains. And they took, unfortunately, what turned out to be the worst shortcut in the history of shortcuts.
Right.
It was an untried trail that cut some miles off of the trek, but took them through some really horrific desert conditions where they lost livestock and it slowed them down because their wagons couldn't get through the sand and things like that. So long story short, they missed getting across this pass, which became known as Doner's Pass, by a day. And when it snowed there, it snowed. So we're talking 10 feet of snow. And instead of going back down, in retrospect, if they'd had a good guide, they'd have gone back down the mountains and camped in the lowlands. They didn't. They stayed up in the mountains. And out of 87 of these folks, about half of them died. And most of them that died were cannibalized. And when I went into to writing this, I really kind of lucked out because there were all of these headlines about that there was this new proof that the Doner Party did not cannibalize. And I went, what? So I contacted Doner Party experts and I said, what's the story? Was there no cannibalism? And, they just kind of shook their heads and said, this is like garbage that just kind of like snuck out of the PR department of a small college that had a researcher doing some work on the Doners, completely misinterpreted the research results, the initial results that this person had come up with, and what came out of it was no cannibalism, and where cannibalism had taken place in four different sites with the Doners. And so, when I went there, they took me out to the site with Kaylee, who was a historical human remains detecting dog. And this was the dog that was trained to find ancient or old human remains, and I was they sort of set me up like a bowling pin because we're walking along these trails and all of a sudden Kaylee takes off and we literally wind up a mile or so off of these established trails that had markers. This is where the camp was. This is where this happened, and we're in the middle of nowhere and the dog is now signaling, alerting. And I'm like, so what's going on here? And he goes, this is where the Alder Creek campsite was. They had it all wrong before. And I'm looking, there's nothing there. There's no excavation, no signs. And so now they're sort of waiting for funds to be able to go in and actually, excavate the area where they believe that George Doner, the leader of the Doner Party, actually died. But there was just so much new stuff that it just turned into a really interesting, 80% of the males died and less than 50% of the females died. And why did that happen? So looking at it from sort of a biologist's perspective, you know, that was another interesting way to look at it.
I mean, if you look at that, because there's whenever there's a survival thing with in retrospect with this, I mean, if you look at sort of shipwreck survivors, you know, the majority of the women, the majority of people who will survive will be the women because of because of body fat and whatever else, and male stupidity in other cases, you know, and bravado. But it's a fact. What did the Donner Party, when this news got out of what had happened, and to a very to and I know I keep going back to this, but you know, the Andes crash, because there was the oh my goodness, they found them after a ridiculous amount of time up in the high Andes, and then there's this horror, and it's 1970, you know, it's early 1970s, so the media's gone completely bananas because they find out, you know, how they survived. You know, the stigma, perhaps, that you know, did the Donner Party have that? I mean, I imagine it would have been even worse for them because you're in the 19th century, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so two things, and you have to remind me to go back to the Donners. But when you're talking about the Andes, they basically got when they were interviewed after, you know, people were looking at the survivors of that rugby team, and there's going to be there's a new show that's going to be on about that coming up soon on TV. When they were not looked upon very positively until one of the guys that was one of the leaders of that group came out and said that he thought that it was okay for, you know, if Jesus Christ ate, if we ate the body of Jesus Christ, then it would be okay for us to consume the bodies of our friends. And when that got out, then the people who were really sort of ready to persecute them backed off big time. And then years later, probably 20, 30 years later, when they interviewed the same guy, they said, "Well, you're really thinking about communion when you were consuming your friend that had died?" And he said, "No, absolutely not. We were starving. We had to eat them or we'd have been dead." But the Donners, when the survivors just sort of blended in quietly into their new situations, into their new, you know, into California, and most of them just didn't really talk about it. There was one gentleman who was the last guy to be recovered. You know, there were like three different rescue parties to pull these people out of there.
Right.
And it wasn't until the second and third rescue party that the rescuers saw that there was cannibalism going on. And the last guy that came out is the one who labeled as the crazy cannibal, because he killed, he supposedly killed a couple of people and ate them on the way out. But for the most part, these people just disappeared. And you never really heard from them again.
Interesting. And the book also, the last one looking back, it looks forward, and that might frighten quite a few people. But, you know, you're saying that, you know, there are some situations that we may be heading down, climate change, famine, disease, overcrowding, that, you know, I'm not saying you should be looking at chomping on Uncle Ernie as an alternative to Sunday lunch. But, you know, we may see the situation getting so stark that people may pick up on cannibalism again.
Yeah, and the unfortunate, I mean, that's horrible, and it's going to happen in places where there's desperate poverty and probably a lot of other folks that are ganging around with guns. But the problem is that there are cannibalism-related diseases like kuru, very closely related to mad cow disease.
Right.
And that is going to be the issue. Now, whether you believe in prions or prions, depending on, you know, where you are, how you pronounce that, where these self-replicating proteins that basically eat holes in your brain, whether you think that they exist or not, and I go into that as well, because I went in there going, well, two people won Nobel Prizes for studying prions in the New Guinea cannibals. In reality, when I talk to major league scientists today, you know, there's a whole group of them that don't believe that prions exist, that what it is a virus, and that the prions are sort of a defensive mechanism by the body. So, yeah, if you and this is something that is incurable, which scientists, anthropologists figured out once they studied what was going on in New Guinea. And if you get something like that going on, I mean, if in isolated areas where you've got you know, where the people are starving and under the gun, literally, then there's a chance that you're going to get these types of encephalopathies being passed from consuming bodies.
Something just fired in the synapse fired in the gray bit of my brain at the back there. Kuru, is that a flesh eating, a brain eating disorder? Which one is that one?
Yeah, it's very much, if you're familiar with mad cow disease, this is an incurable disease that basically turns your brain tissue into it's kind of like Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's may be on the same spectrum, but it is a degenerative brain disease that was first discovered in the early 1950s when researchers, anthropologists, went into the highlands of New Guinea and found that the Foré, who were the indigenous people of the highlands, were, you know, about 6% of them were suffering from this horrible disease. And it was eventually traced to the fact that they consumed their dead and they were eating the parts of the bodies, the nervous system that was contaminated. Mm-hmm. Now, whether, as I said before, whether it's contaminated by a self-replicating protein, which is called a prion, no one's ever seen one, or whether it is a something that would commonly be called a slow virus, we don't know yet, and so the jury is really still out as far as I'm concerned. And I came out of the book going prions, I'm not so sure now. Mm. So that is a problem, and it is a problem, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I always see these things on online of like, what would you not eat? And I wouldn't eat brain. I wouldn't eat anything's brains just because of the fact that if it's got, you know, if it's contaminated and you consume it, then cooking it doesn't destroy these prions, or evidently doesn't destroy this virus. So yeah, it's kind of a scary disease.
Stay clear of the brain. And talking about bits that you maybe want to eat, there's been a lot of new agey stuff recently, and a lot of, obviously, and people getting more spiritual and, you know, giving back to the earth. And a lot of people, or a lot of people in a certain group, believe that eating a part of the human body after birth, in fact, is a spiritual and healthy thing to do.
Yeah, consuming a placenta after you've given birth is to me the last vestiges of what was one of the big surprises in writing a book about cannibalism was the fact that, given the fact that it was this huge taboo for hundreds and hundreds and years, that from the Middle Ages right up to the early 20th century, body parts in mostly in Europe were consumed to cure every type of disease or malady that you can think of.
Body parts were consumed. We're not talking a toenail here, are we, Bill?
Oh no, we're talking about like fat. We're talking about ground up bone. We're talking about blood, organ parts. Yeah, and then that information got buried, but you know they ground up mummies because they mistranslated the Arabic word mumia. They thought it meant like, you know, the dead guys wound up in gauze, and in actuality it meant this kind of tarry bitumen substance. So there was a run on mummies, and you know there was a black market ersatz mummy industry.
That's a surprise to them in the afterlife, wouldn't it? You're sitting there one day having a quiet chat with Ra, and the next thing you know, you're finding yourself in a paste.
Yep, that's right. So what were we talking about?
We're talking about
placenta.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think, you know, once you hit the early part of the 20th century, that stuff, most of that went out the window, although the Merck Index in 1919 still had mummia listed in it.
You know, right.
A big pharmacological catalog. But yeah, folks that consume their placentas believe that it started out as a new age thing, and now it's more or less an alternative medicine thing as a way to restore the hormone balance, and to cure the what we call the baby blues after you give birth. You know, you have these deep depressions and then it goes away and it comes back. And these people believe that by consuming their placentas that they can, that they can alleviate that. And so I had finished writing the book, and I was just, one of the last things that I was doing before I turned it in, was, you know, I wanted to get an interview with somebody who did this for a living, who went around to hospitals and had clients, and she would take their placenta and prepare it in various ways. She could dry it out and then powder it and put it into capsules. If you wanted it fresh, you could make like a, you know, you can make a smoothie out of it.
I can see that at Starbucks going down. Well, a treat, but there you go.
Oh yeah, or with extra caramel.
Exactly.
So I, after I got done talking to her, she goes, well, you know, it's too bad that, and she was in Texas and I was in New York. She says, oh, too bad you can't come down here now because you could eat my placenta. I just gave birth. And I was like, what? I'm thinking to myself, did this woman just ask me to come down to Plano, Texas and consume her placenta? And she goes, oh, yeah, my husband is a chef. He can prepare it any way you want. He would make tacos out of it, whatever. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm writing a book about cannibalism and I had the chance to, like, eat this part of this woman's placenta and I didn't do it, then 10 years down the road, I'm going to be kicking myself in the behind going, damn, I wish I'd have gone down
there. I wish I'd have had a placenta taco.
So the way my wife describes it is, like, 15 minutes later, I had tickets to go to Texas. I went down there, and it was, you know, I also write fiction. I have 3 novels out, and if you'd ask me to write this story and make it as strange as possible, I could not have made up anything that was as weird and ultimately wonderful. Or, you know, she says, you know, well, there was this big windstorm when I land, right before I landed, there's this massive windstorm in Texas.
Yeah.
All no power. So she calls me up and she says, you know, well, our plans are going to change a little bit. I was supposed to go to her house. She goes, you know, I have 10 kids. They're all homeschooled and the babysitter is not going to be able to take them. So my, all my children are going to be there. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And I've got all this, I'm sort of envisioning like the women who lived in a shoe, that type of thing. But they turned out to be such wonderful people and really kind. And so I get there and here's this guy dressed up in a chef's outfit with a hat. And he's like, how do you want it? And I'm like, ossobuco, I guess. No. Yeah, you know, he said, you can make it a taco, you can make it ossobuco, because I've just got all of these fresh organic vegetables. And I was, you know, my response was like, oh, thank God, because there's no way that I'm eating your wife's placenta if those vegetables are not organic.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, so, but Bill, the thought strikes me. You know, when you meet your future mother-in-law, she cooks for you for the first time. Yeah, and you have to give it a good review. So, you know, just take me through the whole. I mean, so it's prepared for you with organic vegetables because, hey, let's keep it healthy. And they're sitting there. I mean, is she sitting across from you? Is the whole family watching you for that first?
Are you going to eat my mommy's placenta?
Is there a Chianti served in the best Hannibal Lecter style?
Oh yeah! Listen, the day before, once I figured out what it was, you know, we had chosen what the dish that he was going to prepare the night before. So on the way there, I stop off at a liquor store, and I'm like thinking to myself, I'm like this, you know, obnoxious New Yorker going up to, I'm looking for the most Texas looking person I can find, a boots, the whole thing.
Yeah.
This six shooter, and I found this woman. I just walked up. I said, "Excuse me, I've got a really kind of interesting pairing for dinner tonight. Maybe you can help me." And long story short, the woman wound up running away from me, and so I grabbed a bottle of Italian red, and that was that. And so he used that in the preparation of this dish. So, you know, I watched them cook it. It smelled really good, they're sort of like the money shot of photographs that they took of me eating this thing. And I, you know, I didn't eat a lot of it, but I sort of cleaned my plate of what there was, and it was delicious.
Good.
You know, it tasted like the, you know, very much like the, you know, what it was cooked in.
Right.
You know, if it was fried, it would have tasted like fried chicken or something, but this was quite good, and I would never do it again, ever, because of disease transmission, and I don't advocate it. And she even, in an interview with me, admitted that what she was dealing with her clients was very obviously the placebo effect, because if you, for example, if you're looking to preserve hormones, which are a type of protein, and then you cook them, then you've just denatured those proteins and they're not working anymore. So she knew that it was mostly in the placebo effect, but it obviously helped people.
I have had guests on, Bill, in the, what, 12 years I've been a radio host now, and I can honestly say that I have never come across one quite like that. And that moment of actually looking down, that moment of truth, as they say in bullfighting terms, you know, when you look down and you see it there, and you suddenly think, oh, well, it's for research. I can understand people throwing themselves out of aircraft and whatever, research, or yomping over the Himalayas, but eating another woman's placenta, you know, having had the invitation itself must have been quite baffling. What do you hope? Because I could talk about body parts, I suppose, for the rest of the, and eating them. We could talk about the whole preparation for the rest of the day. But what do you hope, Bill, that people take out, if you pardon the expression, from the book Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History?
Oh, shoes. Some of the themes are that culture is king, and it's us who decide what you know what's right and what's wrong. And that the other thing is that cannibalism is really widespread across the entire animal kingdom. Very, very common in animals like insects, and once you get into the vertebrates, fish. But then as you get into the mammals, it's less frequent. When you get into the primates, infrequent. But that it occurs for reasons that have nothing to do with hunger or stress. But there's all sorts of reasons why, and I go through these, and I think that they're interesting. And I wrote this book without a lot of jargon in it, and I wrote it with humor where appropriate. You know, when you're writing a book about cannibalism, you got to be careful about yucking it up. But but there were certainly parts in there that I think were, you know, this whole placenta eating adventure was to me very humorous.
Well, it's
so yeah. A lot of people have been reading the book, and I've gotten a terrific response from folks. So,
and it's hopefully
available out there in any format that you want
to. Hopefully, people haven't been afraid to say, "Look, I've just got my placenta. Please pop round. We'll do tacos. We're going to do placenta pleats pizza."
I don't think it's pretty rare nowadays that folks are doing this, because everyone's so conscious now about diseases and things like that.
If people want to find you online, Bill, where can they go to find you?
Oh, sure. Bill Schutt, BILLSCHUTT.com. I'm also, I've got a Twitter account, and also, Amazon page and Goodreads page. I'm pretty easy to get a hold of as far as that goes. And if you have, if your listeners have questions, I'm very happy to answer stuff like that.
Well, absolutely, Bill. As always, this particular book was called Cannibalism, Perfect Natural History. Bill, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I'm very glad that I had lunch before I did this, and that you had breakfast. And we'll steer clear about this. And have a great festive season, and try and stay within the reasonable bounds of cuisine, shall we?
Yes, I'll give it a shot. And listen, really nice talking to you again. And hopefully we'll get to chat after my book on teeth comes out in a year or so.
Can hardly wait for that one. But in the meantime, Bill Schutt, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.